Our second case this morning is 2021-26, State of Ohio versus Shannon Kidd. For Mr. Kidd, we have Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Appellate Rule 5 has no fixed deadline in it, and there are good reasons for that. One of those reasons is that sometimes a person can sit in prison for years until they understand that they actually have a reason to appeal, that their sentence is illegal, and that they should appeal. And that's why we have, that's one of the reasons why we have Appellate Rule 5, is so that, why it is open-ended, so that a person can bring a claim and show that their sentence is illegal. And that's what this court, Chief Justice O'Connor's concurring opinion in Henderson explained. Serious mistakes can happen. And it's not just this case, there are other cases where people have been, where courts have interpreted sentences to be life without parole, where someone should be parole eligible. And people should not have to die in prison because of mistakes like this. Shannon Kidd filed his appeal, first learned that he had an illegal sentence in the summer of 2020. When
counsel, yeah. Your client, was sentenced at 40 to life. Was that the amount of time we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. He is now eligible to be released after 25 years. Is that correct?
Well, under Senate Bill 256, he did have a parole hearing. However, those rules for parole can change over time, but the one thing that remains constant is the sentence in the judgment entry, and that if the rules end up changing, he'd be stuck back with his sentence of 40 years to life.
Well, not if he's released at 25.
Not if he's released, but there also he would still go out on parole, and if there are violations, he would come back, and it would determine. And there would be if he actually is released after 25, there could be violations, he could come back, and what's the minimum sentence after that? It could change over time. And that's why the sentence and the piece of paper signed by the judge matters.
Counsel, it's not in dispute that your client was sentenced under the incorrect law, is that correct?
I don't think it's reasonably under dispute. I think my friend on the other side has said that because of incorrect rulings by the 8th District that it was somehow a legal sentence. I'll let my friend on the other side explain that position better than I can.
Well, what rule would you have us fashion towards a discretionary rule for the district courts that would direct them to grant in certain situations, like your clients, the ability to proceed with their claim?
I have a broader rule and then a narrower rule. The narrower rule with the proposition of law says when two things come together, learning that you have an illegal sentence and that the procedural rules change and how you do that. However, I think I suggest that just the simple illegal sentence is what should matter.
Is that any time anyone claims they have an illegal sentence, or would it be that they have to prove they have an illegal sentence to have the right to appeal? How do you square that?
When they show in their delayed appeal motion that their sentence is illegal, the court should grant it.
So it's not just a claim that they have an illegal sentence; it would be actually making some kind of showing that they do, in fact. This is almost like you have to show the merits of the appeal before you are allowed to appeal, kind of thing.
Or I would at least say if there's something that they can at least, if they make a fanciful claim, if my client had filed something, said my sentence is illegal, I should have been given, the only sentence was probation, because I can see that, but as long as there's something plausible.
Al, so let me ask a different question. As Justice Donnelly mentioned, this is an abuse of discretion standard, correct?
I would think when it's legal, I'm arguing a legal standard. So it, I would argue that it should be de novo. What if the standard is if there is an illegal sentence, you should grant it.
But Appellate Rule 5, though, is an abuse of discretion standard in this court, correct?
If, I don't know if there is a statement. There is one case where the person gave absolutely no reason why they do it. But I would say you can have, and even with an abuse of discretion, if you can show a legal error, you should be able to, that is decided de novo. Also point out, this is the same standard that you'd apply for a 5C appeal from the prosecutor's office by leave of court. So whatever standard is set here for the broadness of breadth of discretion would apply to the state if they wanted to use their leave of court appeal.
Counsel, do we know
exactly what happened? What evidence is in the record that Mr. Kitten did between finding out that he was serving a sentence of 40 years to life in 2011 through when he filed in 2020?
Well, what he learned, what the record shows is we have an affidavit from both him and from Deputy Director Beeler that says that he didn't know that that sentence was actually illegal until our office pulled the criminal file in 2020 and found a letter from 2005 from the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction that they sent to the office of my friend on the other side, the prosecutor's office, and they sent to the trial court, but they never sent to Shannon Kidd. It's not, the letter was addressed to the trial court and CC'd to the prosecutor, but not to my client. And that's when we discovered that his sentence was illegal. And that's important because just knowing that your sentence is not what you expected, disappointment isn't an appealable issue. Illegality is an appealable issue. And that's in 2020 is when he actually learned, my sentence is illegal. I was sentenced under the wrong law. You can't give me Senate Bill 2 time for a pre-Senate Bill 2 offense, for a pre-Senate Bill 2 offenses.
But he knew in 2011, 2012 that his sentence wasn't what he had thought it was, right? So didn't he have some duty to investigate at that point?
I think that it's not fair to put that much, to put the duty of legal inquiry on understanding the Ohio sentencing laws and how they change over time over someone sitting in a penitentiary. That's why we have lawyers. That's why we have lawyers is to tell people things like that. And when our office finally did was able to pull the file from the court and look at it, and someone and the lawyer who was looking at the file on his behalf looked at it, they said, oh, wait a minute, this is illegal. You can't do a sentence like this.
Well, sir, we don't know why the Court of Appeals denied relief to file, right?
Correct. Yeah, within days of filing, yes, they just summarily denied it. They gave no reason, it was a one-line denial.
So is your argument here that the Court of Appeals abused its discretion because they denied leave to file a motion for a delayed appeal on an issue where there was clearly a sentence imposed unlawfully?
Yes, that's one of the arguments. If we're under the abuse of discretion standard, we still win because a clear legal error would be an abuse of discretion. And there's no
and is there, the illegality was manifest to the Court of Appeals at the time the motion for delayed appeal was filed?
Yes, it was in the we attached documents to the motion for leave for delayed appeal. We included the affidavit, the letter from the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, the plea agreement, and so yes, it should have been obvious to the court at that time. I mean, the state never contested the fact that this crime occurred in January of 1996, and Senate Bill 2 became effective in July of 1996. There's never been any question about that in this case.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Harvey, the rule you want us to write, I guess, is that if there's a clear legal error that affects the length of a sentence, then it's an abuse of discretion for Court of Appeals not to grant leave to appeal. Does that sum it up, or Would you?
What
about a diligence requirement? I understand in this case, you think that whatever requirement he had was satisfied, but I would presume you would, I won't presume anything, but shouldn't a court be able to look at, in the exercise of its discretion, whether someone sat on their rights or whether they timely filed an appeal or timely asked for? Again, outside the case, I know your position in this case is that he was diligent, but in another case where someone knew something was wrong, say.
I still don't. If the sentence is illegal and they could spend years in addition in prison as a result of that, then I would still say that enough should be enough to grant leave. Maybe there's one where someone was given a life sentence where the maximum sentence was 10 years and we had to correct it. These mistakes happen. Someone shouldn't have to die in prison because they waited a year too long to file their motion for leave to file a delayed appeal. There's a reason why there's no deadline in Appellate Rule 5. We want to give, it is a safety valve rule. Another example this court granted about 10 years after the fact, in the Moore case, granted a delayed reconsideration motion where there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that made the sentence unconstitutional.
Counsel, should this rule only apply to cases that result in a conviction through a negotiated plea agreement where neither side really tends to have any inclination to appeal such a result, as opposed to a sentence that was rendered after a trial with counsel there and the ability to correct on direct appeal any error?
I think that's a factor in his favor in this case. I wouldn't limit it to those factors, because in the end, when the General Assembly says this person should have at least the chance to seek relief after a certain period of time, and the trial court doesn't do that, that's why we have appeals courts. That's why we have safety valves in the system. That's why we have rules like Appellate Rule 5 that don't put deadlines, that don't include fixed deadlines, that give people the chance to make this. And I don't think
We've also instructed counsel in our recent jurisprudence that whoever has the onus to appeal, the burden's on them to correct sentencing errors on direct appeal. That you also have the post-conviction process if you have ineffective assistance of counsel to address errors in sentencing.
Well, yes, and two things on that. First of all, that Henderson decision was written about 5 weeks before we filed filed the appeal in this case. So that he was not on notice from Henderson. So if this court wants to limit to that, it still should grant Shannon relief. But also, and as I pointed out in my brief, I cited cases from Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Texas, Louisiana, other courts that have said that you can come back, that other states allow people to come back in this extreme situation where the sentence is something that just wasn't authorized by law, where they're sentenced under the wrong statute.
Mr. Harbrick, so pre-Harper and Henderson, this would have been a void sentence, which could have come back at any time because it would have been a void sentence. So once Henderson was decided, what was it, 37 days, and this motion was filed?
So around that time, yeah.
Should we work from the date of the decision where the law changed? Because other than that, they could have come back at any time. There was no time deadline on a void judgment.
Correct. Because that's when this court changed the rules. And I can say why he learned about this in the summer of 2020. And at that point, it would have been a waste of judicial resources to litigate a void sentence motion, given that the issue was before this court and uncertain. Either this court would rule and keep the voidness rule, and then he could file in November, or this court would have gone the other way, and we would have been arguing in the lower courts over something that this court was going to resolve one way or the other anyway. It would have been, I just don't think it would have been a productive use of anyone's time to file a motion in June or July of 2020. it just couldn't have been resolved in any way in time. And again, let's come back to the brief where we showed a case out of Summit County where someone was, where the Ninth District has interpreted a sentence that was just for life to mean life without parole when that sentence was illegal, when life without parole wasn't an option. Another case out of the Sixth District where the court didn't fix another illegal sentence involving a life sentence. These cases happen, and usually in the most serious cases, they often don't learn about this until they start to become parole eligible. That's normal. Until you start getting close to when you think you're going to be paroled, that's when people actually start looking at the case again and start and notice these things. And I also want to come back to the fact that the Department of Rehabilitation Corrections in 2005 notified the trial court, notified the prosecutor, and neither the trial court nor the prosecuting attorney took any action based on that letter to fix the sentence in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Hardwick. Ms. Miranda.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, Anthony Miranda on behalf of the state of Ohio. I'd like to start first with parole eligibility. Chief Justice O'Connor, you noted that Mr. Kidd is eligible for parole. When Mr. Kidd filed his memorandum in support, he was arguing that his illegal sentence unjustifiably delayed his parole consideration. But because he's eligible for parole this month, in fact, he has already seen the parole board, we respectfully submit that this is not the same appeal that the court thought it was accepting. He's already received the ultimate relief that this court can grant him. And so I would just renew.
What's the ultimate relief that this court can grant him?
Well, so if the court were to order resentencing, he could get a sentence which would only matter to the extent he would be eligible for parole. That's really the only tangible.
And he would have been eligible for parole sooner than the 25 years that the new statute provides, correct?
Well, we don't concede that. I guess my point is, if this court orders resentencing tomorrow, say down the line here, he's going to get the same relief he already has. He's already seen the parole board. The court can't obviously give him relief for prior eligibility.
Counsel, do you understand that this sentence is illegal?
We don't agree with that, Your Honor. At the time the sentence was imposed, the 8th District Court of Appeals issued an en banc opinion saying that Senate Bill 2 was applicable to pre-Senate Bill 2 crimes. This court obviously overruled that decision a few months after Mr. Kidd was sentenced. From the perspective of the sentencing court, it's not clear that an error occurred when sentence was imposed. Moreover, at resentencing, at any future resentencing, State versus Thomas would control any sentencing imposed in the future. In State versus Thomas, the court looked at very similar circumstances. It looked at a rape and a kidnapping charge that arose from offenses occurring prior to Senate Bill 2, and it involved a sentencing that occurred after House Bill 86, so after an amendment to Senate Bill 2. And this court said that the definite range of 3 to 11 is less than or more beneficial to the defendant than the indefinite pre-Senate Bill 2 range of 5 to 25. So even if the court were to reverse the decision to grant delayed appeal and a resentencing were ultimately ordered, State versus Thomas controls, and at resentencing, Mr. Kidd would be subject to that definite range of 3 to 11 years. The only distinguishing argument.
Counsel, what would his sentence be if we order a resentencing?
Opposing counsel's only challenging the non-life count, so rape and kidnapping specifically. Under Thomas, the court could impose a definite sentence anywhere within the range of 3 to 11 if there were a resentencing. And the only way that Kidd distinguishes this case from Thomas is by saying he's serving an unrelated life sentence for murder. And he argues that that for some reason means that Thomas doesn't control, but under State versus Saxon, we know that we don't look at sentences in totality as a sentencing package. We look at individual counts and decide what sentence is applicable to each count. And Thomas involved the exact same types of offenses, rape and kidnapping. So even if this court were to order resentencing, I think he would be subject to the same prison sentences he's serving today. But my overarching point here in asking the court to affirm is the issue of discretion. And there are two primary factors that the lower court could properly have considered in denying leave. The first is the amount of delay. There's a well-established case law from lower courts that
Mr. Miranda, should delay really matter if it's truly an unlawful sentence?
I think it does matter, Your Honor, because it's not a cost-free decision to allow a direct appeal years later. For example, there's no transcript of this sentencing.
Therein lies the problem. I mean, if it's an illegal sentence, the burden is still upon the defendant or the appellant to show that it's an illegal sentence. So if that can't be shown, then he loses the appeal.
That's true, Your Honor. There are some arguments that are going to be that the absence of a transcript isn't going to be that dispositive. Right. Issues you can presume regularity. There are going to be other arguments, though. For example, what was Mr. Kidd's position at sentencing regarding the application of Senate Bill 2? We know, for instance, that in Delgado, in Rush, in Thomas, all three of those cases, the defendants did not want pre-Senate Bill 2 to apply. But I can't really raise a waiver argument or an invited error argument without a transcript of the proceeding. So that's an example of why the lower courts have built into the discretionary review the standard of reasonable diligence.
You have the pre-sentence investigation, though. Wouldn't that be helpful?
The pre-sentence investigation, Your Honor, is helpful to, I think, some of the facts. It's not helpful in terms of the legal positions of the parties at the time of sentencing. It doesn't indicate, for example, whether Mr. Kidd asked that Senate Bill 2 be applied.
Is there a sentencing entry? Counsel, is there a sentencing entry?
Yes. It obviously imposed Senate Bill 2 sentences. My point is we don't know whether or not Mr. Kidd asked that Senate Bill 2 be applied, or did he object and say, no, we want a prior Senate Bill 2 to be applied. We don't have the transcript because the delay in this case is over two decades. And on the spectrum of motions for delayed appeals, that's an extraordinary amount of delay. We're not talking about delay of months or years. And then in addition to delay, the second...
Who's responsible for the fact that the transcript is not available? It's the state, right?
No, with respect, it's Mr. Kidd. It's not enough in these matters. This is established not only in motions for delayed appeals, but delayed applications for reopenings. It's not enough for defendants to claim ignorance of the law.
Well, whose policy is it to destroy the transcripts after 12 years? It's not Mr. Kidd's, is it?
No, I believe it's the court reporter's policy, and that could be a local, I don't have any idea what other jurisdictions do, but there's certainly no requirement in the law that the court reporters keep that material indefinitely. And
the prosecutor's office doesn't have a copy of it either?
Correct. To my knowledge, we do not. And in fact, if it were ever prepared, if the raw material ever was made to make a transcript, then it would be made. But
that's
the court reporter doesn't.
There's no appeal.
Correct. And so then the second factor that the Court of Appeals, I think, was fair to look at is the evidentiary support presented in the motion. And Mr. Kidd claims that he didn't take a timely appeal because he was never given an appellate advisement. And the only evidence in the record in support of that claim is his self-serving affidavit. So again, there's no transcript, there's no affidavit from his trial counsel saying that no advisement was given. So on the spectrum of motions that the courts of appeals get, this is on the lower end of the spectrum. Based on those two factors.
But this was a plea, so it's kind of believable that he might not have been advised, isn't it?
It's possible, Your Honor, but again, it's the defendant's obligation to establish the basis for his delayed motion. And there, it's not an unqualified right to a delayed appeal whenever he wants. And the Court of Appeals, this court has recognized the lower court's discretion for 70 years now in the area of delayed appeals. And if the Court of Appeals can't deny a motion filed 22 years later, it's not clear to me what remains of the lower court's discretion. I'm not sure what circumstance still exists where it can reasonably be denied.
Counsel, what weight do you give the letters that were received by the prosecuting attorney's office and the court in, I believe, 2005, identifying the illegal sentence? What weight do you give that?
So the letter sent from the ODRC to the court raised an issue about whether the sentence was consistent with Senate Bill 2. Obviously, the letter was sent after the court's decision in Rush. It doesn't speak, however, to the issue of delay. It doesn't say anything about whether Mr. Kidd was advised of his right to appeal.
That's not what their intent of the letter was. The intent of the letter was say, here's a red flag. You know, there's a problem here. It should have gone to Mr. Kidd, or at the very least, his last counsel. Instead, it went to the court and to the prosecuting attorney, both of whom did nothing.
Your Honor, we received a copy of it, but it was directed to the court. It raised an issue. It didn't, it obviously didn't command the court to do anything. But certainly,
The letter, the ODRC can't command the court to do anything.
Right, correct. So it raised an issue. Certainly Mr. Kidd could have, under the prior voidable sentencing jurisprudence, could have raised the issue at any time. And he never raised that issue, despite knowing in 2011 or 2012 that his assumption that he'd be eligible for parole after 14 years was untrue. He knew that in 2011, 2012, and he didn't file his motion for delayed appeal until 2020, more than 8 years later. And that's just simply not, there's no justification for that amount of delay.
So he went into the prison system as a juvenile, right?
He committed the crimes as a juvenile. At the time of the plea and sentencing, he was 18, or 18 or 19, but he committed the crimes as a juvenile, yes.
Well, I'm going to assume for the severity of the crimes, he was locked up from the time he was under 18, correct?
He was locked up for an unrelated offense, and so there was a delayed prosecution of a few years. So the crime occurred in 1996. He was sentenced in 1998. So he committed the crimes as a juvenile. That's why he gets the benefit of Senate Bill 256. However, at the time of the plea and sentencing, he was an adult.
Thank you.
And so I would just, again, I would emphasize the policy concerns we have with granting delayed appeals after so much delay. I've already referenced the fact that there's no transcript, and why I think that raises issues for litigation. We cited to an Eighth District case where they had granted a delayed appeal after a long period of time, and really, I think, regretted it, openly expressed question about whether or not it was improvidently allowed. That's State versus Hunt. And then lastly, you know, there is a real harm to the finality of judgments, and the victims' families who are notified after two decades that issues they thought were settled are now subject to fresh litigation. That's not in the state's judgment.
Counsel, let me ask you, what kind of an illegal sentence do you think should be the subject of a delayed appeal?
Your Honor, I don't dispute that Mr. Kidd could raise this issue in a delayed appeal. I'm just submitting that it's not an unlimited right to a delayed appeal. He has some obligations of diligence. And, you know, if he had filed his delayed appeal days after this court's decision in Rush.
But Ms. Miranda, doesn't that assume, as was mentioned earlier by one of the justices, by counsel, Mr. Hardwick, that non-lawyer defendants are to know all the rules?
Yes, defendants are held to some expectation that they exercise their rights, not only in the delayed appeal context, but in other contexts like untimely applications for reopening.
But isn't there also a recognition of the inability to facilitate representation when you're incarcerated?
Certainly, Mr. Kidd could have sought representation. There's no right to representation post-conviction.
So if he's indigent, if he can't afford his own lawyer, and he's contacting the public defender's office and their backlog, or he can only wait until someone responds, I mean, but it's, you're right, it's not an unfettered right to have a delayed appeal granted, but it has to be tempered with what the appeal would show. And talking about an unlawful sentence, it seems like time restraints should be a little more loose than maybe some other instances of delayed appeals.
I understand that, and I would just again emphasize 2011, 2012, there's a highlighted problem for him, and his motion's not filed until 2020. So
counsel, would you say that you know, given the lack of resources, legal resources, in other words, access to an attorney, that there should have been a pro se filing by the defendant, who presumably has an abbreviated education level, and to make this argument for a delayed appeal, again, pro se?
Yes, Your Honor. He had that.
That's what you're saying, that should happen in situations such as this, a pro se appeal.
Yes, I respond to pro se motions like that. There are other remedies such as post-conviction petitions that we see that are pro se. So we think the remedies that exist are adequate. And for that reason, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Hardwick, I think you used all of your time, if I'm not mistaken. So I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is no reasonable way why counsel in this case would have requested to be sentenced under Senate Bill 2. You have the same maximum sentence under both laws, life, but under Senate Bill 2, the trial court can make parole eligibility as late as 53 and a half years, and under pre-Senate Bill 2, the limit is 32.2 years. Trial counsel would have had to be insane to have made a request like that. I'd also like to, you know, when it comes to which law would apply, I don't think there are also ex post facto issues involving increasing the range of a person's prison term after the fact. And again, the statute, I think, does apply differently in these cases. Finality is an important virtue, as my friend on the other side says, but it is not the only virtue. Sentencing someone within the lawful limits is an important part of our justice system. Imposing a sentence, courts should only impose sentences that are within the range provided by the General Assembly, and when they fail to do so, court allow remedies that delayed appeals to be granted.
Counsel, one question. Is there anything in the record about Mr. Kidd trying to get counsel from 2011 or 2012 to through 2020 or to file something?
No, it says our office just gave him general information about Graham, but nothing else. What it does show is there's a plausible explanation. The fact that once we have an affidavit from a lawyer, an officer of the court, who said, we pulled the file, we discovered the error, we told him about the error, and that's when I believe he learned of the error. That's when I talked to him, that's when he learned of the error. So there is an affidavit from an officer.
What was the date of that?
That was 2020. That was in 2020, just before we filed the okay. Motion for.
I got you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement and be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a 10-minute recess?
The court will now adjourn for 20-minute recess.